This summer, click into cordless power with Memorial Day savings at the Home Depot. Tackle more than half an acre of grass with the convenience and gas-like power of the Ryobi 40-volt battery-powered mower. And keep your flower beds fresh with the 40-volt cordless string trimmer. Then clear debris with the 40-volt jet fan leaf blower. Click into Memorial Day savings happening now at your cordless power source, the Home Depot. How doers get more done.
Okay, let's do some quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. That's obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. To reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. Here's the thing. Information is power. Information is money. Literally, the currency of today's world of entrepreneurship is information. And if you could bring all of the information about your business into one dashboard, this is incredibly valuable. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform and one source of the truth about your business. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, access from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. And you're improving efficiency by bringing all of your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. This is so valuable. You just hit a button and you can see all the information about your business instead of having to like call five different departments and get all these emails and put it all together and make sense of it. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math, see how you'll profit with NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/James. netsuite.com/James. netsuite.com/James.
This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show on the Stansberry Radio Network.
Welcome Jason Calcanis to the show, world famous internet entrepreneur. Jason, I feel like, how long have we actually known each other? It's like about 18 or 19 years.
Yeah, it's closer to 20 than 10 or 15, for sure.
Yeah, and so you initially started with the Silicon Alley Reporter, which I thought was a great idea. Like literally every month, or I don't know, was it every month?
It was, monthly. I think we did 10 times a year. And then like advertising got really good. So we actually moved it up.
and it was great because all the companies in the space were basically website development companies and DoubleClick. Like that was Silicon Alley. And it was great to know basically when all my competitors landed a new client, I would find out in the Silicon Alley Reporter where I was the first, I think I was like the biggest advertisement. I was either on your front page or your back page.
Yeah, you had you took a bold step and you got rewarded because you took a $1,000 ad, which is like people were like, "How much are the ads?" And I was like, and I was about to say $100 or $500, and I just thought, why don't I just add a zero? So $1,000, and people were like, $1,000? How many does it go to? And I was like, it goes to 10,000 people. They're like, do you know how expensive that is? I was like, no, but they were like, well, client engagement's $100,000, so this kid's an idiot. Well, and then 30 people bought ads, and then I tripled the price.
We're underlining also how bad a negotiator I was and still am, that I was just like, okay, yeah, $1,000, here's a check. I had no idea.
Well, your contemporary Jeff Dauchess like ground me down.
Yeah, he's a good negotiator. He's smart. So you did the Silicon Alley Reporter. Then Silicon Alley just totally combusted. Like it just all blew up. I think at one time, did you ever get any offers for the Silicon Alley Reporter to buy it, like at the peak?
$20 million from Alan Meckler.
Yeah, so I'm assuming you turned it down because obviously you love doing it.
At the time, I felt I was the Silicon Valley reporter. Like, people would refer to me. They would introduce me. Hey, this is the Silicon Valley reporter. Like, what's your name, actually? It's Jason. Oh, okay. But yeah, it's a Silicon Valley reporter. So it actually became a descriptor and a title more than, you know, a brand name.
You were at every party. You were having conferences. Like, it really,
I was
really
the party.
Kind of the center.
I was the party.
Yeah, exactly. And then you rented some sort of like huge loft space too that was like completely empty except for you.
That was my apartment.
Right.
And I would do the photo shoots there. You were there for the Silicon Alley 100. So yeah, it was a great time in my life.
Yeah, and then you started Weblogs Inc., which was like, now we call them blogs, but you were still calling them weblogs, which was the term people were using. So it was this kind of infrastructure for people to blog with, which AOL bought for, I don't know, 20 or 25 million, something like that. And you stayed at AOL for a while. And now you started Mahalo, which has turned into inside.com. And you're also, I think your biggest thing now, obviously, is you're a super angel investor. You're in Uber. You're in all sorts of companies.
Yep.
So I think these are the highlights. You also have the show, which I've been on several times, This Week in Startups, Twist, which is a show and a podcast. So I kind of want to take it back to the beginning, because right after you started Silicon Valley Reporter, we met. I forgot who arranged it. It was you, me, another guy. And I said to you, Jason, you know so much about all of these companies that are starting. Why don't you either advise a venture capitalist or become a venture capitalist yourself? And you said, I don't like to do that. I only want to invest in myself.
Yeah, it was a huge mistake. It's terrible advice. And that's why I passed on investing in Twitter and Zynga, because I thought, oh, well, I'll just invest in myself. Why would I invest in my friends? And then I stopped overthinking it, and I did both. I invested in Uber and Thumbtack and other companies that my friends did, and I also invested in myself. But yes, the point at that time was I really didn't think angel investing was going to be for me, because I like to build stuff. But you know, you get to a certain age. I'm 43 now, and you know, I've built a lot of things, and I know how it works, and I have a stack of chips, and so I can put the chips to work more efficiently than in the public markets, and it's more fun to have more friends and place more bets. So I've come to the conclusion that at my heart, I'm a risk taker, a gambler, and a good friend to people. And so, you know, angel investing is a really great way to do those things. I can take risk. I can hang out with my friends. I can back their companies. I can make new friends by backing their companies. And it appeals to my, you know, gambling nature. I very much like to play poker. I like to play high card. I like to sit there and pull a card from the deck and bet you $1,000 that my card is higher than yours. The stupidest bet in the world, I find very entertaining.
That's funny. Actually, that's a game I play with my then 12-year-old daughter. That was kind of our one big game that we would play with each other. It was a game similar to that. And she enjoyed it very much. But I do want to say, investing in yourself was probably your greatest gain in net worth, because when you sold people, you know, like, it's one thing when you invest $25,000 and you have a huge hit and it's great, it feels great. But it's another thing to go from zero, build a company every day, and then sell it for $20 million, which you did with Weblogs Inc. And this was after having a bust with Silicon Valley Reporter, which was a great magazine, wasn't your fault. Obviously, the whole internet busted, but still, it must have felt pretty bad. And then you built up something from scratch again and made the biggest gain in net worth that you'll ever have in your life, no matter what else you do.
Well, not exactly correct, because I invested in Uber. But
I understand, but still, not. 0 to 20 million is more than 20 million to 300 million.
Well, 0 to 30 million. But anyway, who's counting? It doesn't matter. Money doesn't matter right now at this point. I'm playing with that. I'm free rolling. But I agree with myself. Let me just say that.
And in 2004 or 2005, one of those years, I visited you. You were in New York and you were doing something with Weblogs Inc. And you kind of, I forgot how it was, whether it was on some social network, which I can't even remember now, or maybe it was your email list. You said you were at this location, which was about a block from my office. So I figured, okay, I'm going to go surprise Jason. So I show up there. We hadn't seen each other in years and no one else was there. You showed me kind of the Weblogs Inc. software and kind of the inner workings of it. You were so excited to show every single detail of this software. This was investing in yourself. The product of investing in yourself was not the money, it seemed to me, was your excitement in what you were doing and what you were creating.
I agree with that. And I would also say that, you know, if you look at the podcast I do twice a week for 5 years, and, you know, I'd done other podcasts in the past, it is also an investment in myself because I spend my time sitting there learning from other entrepreneurs and investors and the guests I have on my show. I've also learned how to be a great interviewer. I went from being a terrible interviewer, I was probably like a 2 out of 10, and now people tell me I'm a 10 out of 10. Maybe I think I'm like an 8 out of 10 or an 8.5 maybe, and still some stuff to learn. But I've been trying to perfect, you know, the interview skill. And the same thing with events. I threw the events for my own intellectual curiosity, but they made me very famous. And, you know, in our circle, not outside of it. I mean, I could walk down the street, you know, in Los Angeles and nobody would know who I am. If I walk down the street in San Francisco or Palo Alto, I'll get stopped 5 times. And so being high profile has huge benefit for me as an angel investor and as an entrepreneur. People want to come work with me. They want to have lunch with me. I mean, if I just want to interview people for a job, I have recruiters pitch me all the time like, hey, you know, I see you need an iOS developer. I'm like, yeah, I don't really need a recruiter. I need more time to meet with all the possible candidates. So if I say like I'm willing to meet with iOS developer candidates, which is the, you know, currently the, you know, most precious resource in the Valley, you know, I could have 20 meetings set up this, you know, for next week. And yeah, a lot of them just want to meet me because they want to pitch me as an angel investor or just get to know me, or they're fans of the show. But at least that starts me on third base in terms of hiring somebody, you know?
So, well, also, I want to remind you of a blog you wrote. It must have been years ago, where you said, ignore all recruiters and just go on LinkedIn and do your own you know, footwork to find the best developers or the best of anything. And you, in the same article, you said, don't use PR firms. And I think in general, you know, the invest in yourself, I'm not even just talking about money. In general, you've kind of perfected the art of the hustle. And, you know what you're capable of. So you go out there and do it, as opposed to kind of hiring a recruiter, hiring a PR firm, wasting all this money that is usually just simply a waste.
Yeah, I have gotten better at that, of just simply figuring it out myself and doing it myself. And that works particularly well for me.
Tell me about Weblogs Inc. Like, why did you think, okay, blogs are going to be huge, they're going to be different than how it's been done before, I'm going to set up this infrastructure so people can create blogs? And then you started Engadget and some other pretty popular blogs at that time through Weblogs Inc.
Yeah, so I thought that blogging was interesting because I had 2 employees at Silicon Valley Reporter, Shenny Jardin and Rafat Ali, or Rafat, and they went on to work at blogs.
Yeah, paidcontent.org also sold for about $20 million. That was Rafat's
Rafat started that while working for me. And I'm an investor in Skift, which is an even better company than Paid Content. He's really, you know, in the zone. And he told me blogs were going to be big. And I remember the conversation of me telling him, like, listen, you can work on your blog on the weekends. It's stupid because you don't have an editor. So nobody's reading what you write. There's spelling errors, there's commas. It doesn't make any sense. And so by all means, go ahead and do your blog. It's dumb. And I was completely wrong. Because even though they weren't edited, the whole point was they weren't edited. So the consumers felt like, oh, this is raw. And that was a very unique experience with writing. So I realized, you know, when Shenny Jardin did Boing Boing and Rafat started doing he doing this, like, hey, this is kind of interesting. So they're actually getting an audience. And I read some story that Rafat was making like $5,000 a month working from home in his underwear. And I was like, oh, that's double what I was paying him. So there's something there. And I started studying it and reading the blogs and Dave Weiner and other people who are blogging and Peter Rojas and, you know, just some of the early people. And we decided to, you know, make a go of it, and it became, you know, one of the biggest hits of my career. And so I'm very proud of it. And it set me up for life, which is great. And now
Mark Cuban invested. Was he a seed investor?
Yeah, he was our only investor. He put in about $300,000 and he got it about $5 million, I think. So it was pretty awesome for everybody involved. And, you know, Mark and I had been friends for a long time before that. And, you know, it was pretty magical. It, you know, just everything just worked in that business. I mean, there were hard times in terms of, you know, servers going down and whatnot. But at that time, there wasn't a lot of new stuff coming out. So when you launched something like Delicious would be something people played with for a month or two, or Flickr or Weblogs Inc. or Gawker, because nothing else was coming out. So you basically were guaranteed that everybody who was in the know would, you know, try your stuff and play with it for a little bit because they had nothing else to do. Now, you know, you have Product Hunt or the Launch Ticker or, you know, whatever. There's so many new products you see every day on AngelList. I mean, it's – and they're good. And none of them get any attention.
Yeah, why is that? Because it does seem like there's a lot of money now flowing into the venture capital space.
Well, the cost of building things has gone down. So when we did Weblogs Inc., you know, there were 3 or 4 days of putting up the servers, 2 or 3 days of getting our phone system put in, and, you know, a couple of days of getting domain names, a couple of weeks of setting up mail servers, you know, like I could go right now. If you said start a company and make it look professional, I literally could go to Squarespace, put up a website, create a MailChimp mailing list, put up a phone system with, you know, one of these phone systems. Nobody uses the phone anyway. Put up a help desk software with Zendesk, whatever.
At Twitter, there's no phones, right? It's just everybody uses their cell phone.
Mm-hmm. They're not the only ones. So you can just pop up a startup in minutes, and you can put a profile up on AngelList. You can set up a bank account instantly. Like, there's a zillion things you can just do, and it's pretty fantastic.
So what if, let's say you were just starting out, like, so a lot of people, they're either graduating college or they're stuck in their cubicles and they kind of wish for a better life, or they're feeling stuck. What directions would you advise somebody to look into to kind of discover a new area of the internet, or what new areas are interesting to you right now as an investor?
Well, as an investor, obviously the on-demand lifestyle, the Uber of X and the Tinder of Y are the two biggest categories people are pursuing. That doesn't mean I'm pursuing them necessarily, but I do think those are the big ones. So you have HomeJoy cleaning your house, and you have all these food delivery services. It's, you know, it's quite interesting. I don't actually think that way. I don't think about like the trends. I like to meet with founders, and I have my own basically system for figuring out how good they are and if I want to be in business with them. And it's, you know, very multifaceted, but just for some highlights, I like to see that the person has a deep, deep knowledge of the industry that they're operating in, the customers, the competitors, you know, the products. And so if we were talking about watches and I said, oh, you want to build a watch, a smartwatch? Okay. You know, what do you think of Apple's watch announcement, or, and what do you think the competitors are? And if you were like, yeah, I didn't see the actual, you know, video of the launch, but, you know, it looks interesting. I'd be like, okay, Apple's in your space and you didn't watch the actual video. I watched the video. I'm not in your space, right? Like, so there's a level of deep, deep, obsessive knowledge that you need to have of all your competitors, of all of the nuances of their products, of the history. Oh, yeah, there was the Pebble watch. It raised $3 million on Kickstarter. At the time, it was the largest amount. They raised money from Charles River Ventures. Like, you should be able to, like, know this stuff cold. If you don't, it's weird. And then I look for just absolutely awesome execution, design, you know, the copy, the details, the finish, the fit, you know. So if you are really knowledgeable and you're executing at a very high level in terms of on a product basis, that's a really good start. You're probably not going to forget everything the next day and stop being able to design good products, if that makes sense.
Right. So you're very founder focused. And I've seen in kind of your descriptions of how you invested in Uber, it was very much focused on the original people as opposed to the idea.
Yeah, of course.
So it's interesting that you say that I've seen a lot of investments cross my desk, which are like the Uber of X. But I sort of feel like Uber is ultimately going to be the Uber of X.
That's probably correct. Now, I don't speak for the company. I don't have any inside information. I specifically don't ask them to give me any inside information, so I don't have these issues. But, you know, you do see them testing a lot of different ideas. And so, yeah.
Well, it seems like what Uber really is, as opposed to kind of like this cab hailing service, is you have people who need something on one side, you have logistics software in the middle, and you have this massive labor force on the Uber side. Now, it just so happens they apply that labor force to picking you up and driving you places, but it could also be, like you say, food trucks, or it could be someone pick up my laundry and get it done and deliver it back to me. Like, there could be lots of things that Uber could ultimately do. The key is that logistics software.
That's absolutely correct. And so, you know, I don't see why an Uber, I mean, I've seen actually my friends do this, like, they couldn't get an Uber in Malibu, so they put the pin for Uber at Duke's, like, you know, at the border of Santa Monica and Malibu, got the driver to go to Duke's. When the driver was outside, my friend texted him and said, I'm actually in Malibu. I'll pay you to drive up here. So start the meter, pick me up here in the colony. And I was like, wow, that's the most impressive hack I've seen. I don't know if the Uber driver is specifically allowed to do that or not, or how anybody would know that there was somebody in the car or not, but it just looks like a two-stop drop-off. But I also know people who've sent an Uber driver to pick up food, like a Postmates or anybody else. And so, you know, there's definitely a way to go about this. And, you know, I don't see why you couldn't order lunch from anywhere and say to the Uber driver, or say to the restaurant, my Uber driver's outside, would you give it to him or her, and then tell the Uber driver, when you're downstairs, I'll come down and get it. I think the Uber driver would do it. So I actually agree with what you're saying, but I don't know that they're going to do that or not.
Yeah. So whether or not they do that officially, you know, I could see it starting to be use cases that already start to happen among users. And then whether it becomes an official service that they offer, who knows? Then there's the flip side of it. Google investing in Uber, combined with the driverless car idea, do you think Uber will eventually be driverless?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think those are, I mean, I heard Elon Musk, and I kind of trust Elon on his estimates more than anybody, and he said 6 or 7 years. So I think that might be a reasonable estimate for some of these things. But I tend to think it's going to take twice as long as, you know, that estimate. I think it might be 10, 15 years. I think the autopilot that he's talked about is what's more likely. You know, you get on a highway, and you can, you know, use your phone and read, because the left lane is only for autopilot cars, and you can't get into the lane unless your car does autopilot. And, you know, everybody drives super fast in there, and it's awesome. And you can read a paper and get that time back. So I think that's what will happen more likely. So, yeah, I'm not really – it's an end of our lifetime issue.
What other kind of trends do you see sort of happening over, you know, so that's obviously an interesting trend. And your friend Elon's obviously doing interesting trends with either electric cars or SpaceX. Are you in SpaceX at all?
No, but I might invest in one of the rounds coming up. You know, SpaceX, I think, is a company that is his true passion. I think, you know, he wants to back up and get to Mars before he dies. So, you know, he's probably got 40 good years left on the planet, and I think he could make it. So I think it's going to take everything in his, you know, in his power to get there. And it's going to take a $50 billion or $100 billion. So, you know, Tesla, you know, if it continues in that trajectory, it might help him pay for a portion of it. And Larry Page said he would give him all his money if he died, or, you know, I think he said that would be a more interesting thing to do. I don't disagree with him. And so, I don't know that SpaceX will ever be a public company or not. I mean, it'll be interesting to see, but he's very long on it. So it's going to be super interesting. I think the democratization of investing is super interesting. So I have my own little fund that I invest in, but I also see things like AngelList or Funders Club or Micro Ventures and Circle Up and a bunch of other places are doing very interesting things in crowdfunding. And Crowdfunder, I think, is another. And what's very interesting about them is, you know, somebody could come in who maybe doesn't have access to deals, and they could back Gil Pacino or Dave Morin or Kevin Rose or Tim Ferriss and put, you know, $3,000 into 30 different deals and put $90,000 to work. And if they had a net worth of $3 million, it would be 3% of their net worth. But they might have just bought a lottery ticket to the next Uber or LinkedIn or whatever. So
right. And so just to explain that, so on AngelList, they allow for syndicates. So I can say, I want to invest in whatever, a small piece of whatever Jason Calacanis invests in. And then I'm in your syndicates on each deal. So that, and that's often a good way, let's just call it middle America, that doesn't have always access to deal flow in Silicon Valley. That's a great way to get access to the people who are putting together these syndicates.
Correct.
So and AngelList is really interesting. I would say AngelList is kind of the leader of the space. And I know I co-invest with Naval actually quite a bit. And I think those guys are just geniuses.
They are geniuses. They're doing a terrific job. And yeah, I'm pretty excited about it.
But if you're starting a company, how do you kind of get visibility on a site like AngelList? You know, there's so many companies out there now starting, kind of getting the front page of AngelList is difficult.
All you have to do is get one of the 20 syndicates to partner with you. So that's it. Very simple.
Hmm. Partner meaning invest?
Yeah. I mean, if you convince Gil Pacino to invest, he then syndicates it. So it's pretty simple. I mean, you just look at those people and you have to build your pitch around what they've invested in before. I mean, I'm shocked at the number of spray and pray startups there are. Forget about angel investors who just, you know, try to get a meeting with everybody they can and they've done no research on them. You know, I've put it out there exactly, you know, what I'm looking for. You can watch me interview other angel investors on my show. And I'm always shocked when I meet with somebody and they're like, oh, you do a podcast? I'm like, really? Okay. You know, like, you really have to be clueless if you're not taking the time to deeply research the people you're meeting with. I want to have complete information advantage over anybody I'm meeting with. So I do massive amounts of research on people, and I don't need to, you know, like, so, but I so do.
So again, there's this hustle aspect, you know, which I'm always going to relate back to the investing in yourself. You're, like you say, you don't need to, but you're doing all the information. You're doing all the research on everyone you meet with. You're really digging down deep on the founders you invest in. And, you know, going back to, you don't use the recruiters or you don't use the PR firms. You do it yourself in many cases. Heck, you create your own platform for spreading news. So
yeah, like I was at a certain point, it was like, I'm not going to beg TechCrunch or, you know, somebody to cover me. I mean, the TechCrunch people wrote a story about Google buying a company for $600 million. They never called Google to check. You know, they accepted a laptop or they asked for a laptop to write a story. I mean, this is like, to be begging TechCrunch to write about you is like just pathetic. So I was like, okay, well, I'll just make my own email list and I'll write to people who matter. And I put 100 people on it. Now it's 40,000. So, you know, over time, you can build up your own email list and your own Twitter following because you produce content on a regular basis. You have something interesting to say. And then I don't need the press. I mean, I can drive more people to a product than TechCrunch can, much more, just with my endorsement of it, just with my, I think this is interesting. I think this is interesting enough to invest in. So I am the press outlet. I am the PR campaign. I don't need the, you know, and I still do PR with people who I think are interesting. I met with TechCrunch. I've had them write stuff up. There are some good writers there. There's a lot of bad ones too. But I think, you know, people need to take ownership of communicating their ideas. And then when it comes to information, like if I'm at a poker table with you and you know nothing about me, but I know your net worth, I know what you do for a living, I know how much you've slept in the last 24 hours. I know, you know, what type of shoes you're wearing, what type of watch you're wearing, and how much those cost. You know, I know that you don't care about the $3,000 in front of you, or you care about it very deeply. And both of those things will impact how you play. And I know you didn't sleep, or I know you got in a fight with your spouse before you got here or whatever. And so if I, the more information I can pull out of you during that poker session and the least I can give you, the better my chances are of beating you or having some advantage. So I always like to have a, you know, asymmetrical advantage on information.
Right. Which, you know, again, starting from Silicon Alley Reporter days, that's basically how you started. It was aggregating the information in the space. So you knew, which essentially made you the central part where everybody had to know you to kind of spread the word.
Yeah, I was lucky at that time that, you know, even though we had the internet, people hadn't figured out how to use it yet. And so there wasn't really a lot of ways to, you know, collect information. So I did become a router of information, which was great.
So now, what are the next IPOs, would you say, that are coming out there in Silicon Valley? So a lot of people, I always hate that on Wall Street, everyone says, oh, maybe we're approaching another bubble again. But when you actually look at it, there's been relatively very little, very few IPOs compared with like a 1999 or early 2000.
In terms of the IPO space, I think, you know, obviously people have been following Airbnb and Dropbox and some of those high growth companies, Uber, obviously. And I think those companies have so many options to not go public that having watched Facebook, you don't have to deal with a lot of drama post their IPO, all of which seems to be water under the bridge now. But it was a huge distraction for a little bit. I don't think anybody's like in some tremendous rush. There's a really cool dynamic that's changed dramatically in the Valley in technology where there are secondary markets for shares where people can get liquidity without needing to go public. So really going public was so everybody could sell their shares and buy houses and, you know, get something for the 7, 8, 9, 10 years they put into their project. And maybe not feel like an idiot if the company went under because they had taken 10% of their shares and sold them. Well, founders, I mean, the founders of Secret, I understand, sold money, sold shares in like the first year. So, you know, this is an untested product. Nobody knows if it's going to work. It's got all kinds of suicide problems and cyberbullying problems and harassment problems because it's anonymous. And they were able to take secondary money off the shares because there's so much demand. So, you know, IPOs are so not important anymore. You know, they're just so
20th century.
I think, you know, I have a new idea for IPOs because, you know, everybody like prices the IPO of Alibaba and then it goes up or, you know, Tesla, you know, does an IPO and then it goes, you know, literally 40x. So it's a much easier thing, I think. IPOs should be a 100-week process. You should have a 100-week IPO. And the way it should work is you have, let's say you're going to have a float of 10% every week, 10 basis points goes out. Every 10 weeks, 1%'s out. And you just, boom. You just slowly sell the shares in an auction style. So
you know,
whatever
that's
share
not
price
a bad
is,
idea. And it's not impossible to do because the market itself is an auction, right? So just the first 1% is, even if you don't do an auction process on the very first 1%, every other 1% will be an auction. So all you have to do is file, you know, in just talking in Wall Street terms, all you have to do is file a shell filing for the full amount of shares and then go public with just that first 1%. That's not an auction, but then every 1% after that is totally an auction.
Exactly.
So companies should do that. That's a good idea.
Well, it keeps every company honest. You know, like now they can, you know, all these companies can not have the VCs or anybody else selling early. They're sort of obligated to keep the company doing well. So you don't have like what happened with Zynga, you know, where like Zynga, you know, people were selling at $9, $10, $11, $12 a share before they went public. And then boom, you know, it goes basically the whole thing goes kaput. And, you know, nobody could sell at $3 a share. That would have made everybody slowly sell their shares. Maybe everybody would have been more focused during that down period, you know?
Yeah, I guess the one issue is if you only have 1 or 2% of your shares outstanding that are out there in the public, then if there's a lot of demand for the company, your price could then immediately go artificially high too early.
But the company would get that money, right? Which is the great part. The company would get that money.
Well, the trading itself, the company doesn't get the money. So the trading itself could drive up. Like this reminds me of 1999. You have like Scient was selling only like 3% of their shares in an IPO. And because there were so few shares out there, but a lot of traders wanted the shares, the price would go up 20% a day.
Possibly. Yeah, we'll see. I mean, somebody have to test it. I think what would happen is the most important thing is the company wouldn't leave that money on the table, the spread.
Right. You know, that's true.
That's I'm thinking about the company. Because the company is, and it would also keep the companies honest. So if it did go up, it would be because the company is so good.
Yeah, that's largely true. It's a function of the trading then as well, but that would be largely true. Definitely the company.
It's possible it could get run up. I mean, I guess.
Yeah. But that's an interesting idea. So tell us about Inside.com. So this is your latest, not latest, but Mahalo.com, sort of more, which you started several years ago, has sort of morphed into Inside.com. And Mahalo was kind of this almost user, I want to call it like a user generated or user curated Google almost. And now you've morphed it.
Correct. You know, one of the observations I had about news was the headlines, and there was great inefficiency, and mobile was a much easier way to consume news and was becoming the primary consumption device for people. So if people on mobile could read news more efficiently, that would be a great thing for them because, you know, bullshit link baiting headlines from Business Insider are really frustrating on mobile. So when they're like, you'll never guess what makes Elon Musk so successful, and then it's like he works 6 days a week, and you're like, thank you for wasting my clicks. Or people are like, oh my god, these are the 7 vegetables that will make you live longer, and then it's like, click the slideshow, and it's like, you know, okay, can you just tell me to eat kale and Brussels sprouts and things that are green? So what I have is I have dozens of curators 24 hours a day reading the best sources of news and summarizing it and putting it into Inside. So if you go to inside.com/space, for example, good domain structure, you can see all the latest news about space. If you go /Ferguson, you can see what's going on in Ferguson. And if you go Star Wars, you can see all the latest Star Wars news. And you can also do that in an app, and you can slide the deck of little summaries and see the last Star Wars story and the Star Wars story before that and the Star Wars story behind that. Or it could be something like Ferguson. And you can, you know, swipe the deck with your thumb and just read the abstracts. Just short 300-character abstracts. You know, basically 2 tweets in one with a small image. And then you link to the source. And a large number of our people link to the sources. And people are spending – there's a contingent of people spending, you know, between 10 and 30 minutes inside the app. They're using it sort of like an RSS reader. And so when they do spend that much time in the app, they're actually spending it at the sources. They're using us as a directory of the best sources. So they read the little tiny abstract we have for long read of the day, like a long read, and they click through and they read it. Or they swipe through 5 long reads, they pick the one they want, they click it, and they read it inside of our app because we have a browser built into the app. So it's really powerful for us if we can get people to click through and start reading. And we're basically a net sender of traffic. So it's great. We're this like little thin layer on top of all this crazy news going on out there.
And how's it going so far?
Yeah, it's going incredible. Like people who downloaded the app over the last 6 months, like a third of them used it last month. So it is incredibly sticky, and, you know, that's awesome, and people spend a lot of time in it. The issue we have is news is not necessarily viral unless you make it salacious and provocative, like, you know, BuzzFeed and Business Insider and Huffington Post and all these people. So because we're being efficient, we don't get to inefficiently trick people on social media. So it's sort of like we have a slow growth company, but if people do engage the product, they stick with it. So we're figuring it out.
what about if people submit news, right? And then you do some Tinder kind of like thing where if somebody swipes on news that I've submitted, or if they scroll down on news I've submitted, I go up in points. So submissions I do get higher ranked somehow.
Yeah, it's possible. We're looking at, you know, submissions from people, and that could help.
Or what about comments?
Yeah, you know, commenting we have, and it turns out nobody wants to comment on mobile. It's just too hard to comment on mobile. Yeah, so it's a little bit of a problem. But we have some other ideas, so don't worry. We figured it out. We have ideas.
So it sounds like you're still involved in lots of things. So Inside.com, This Week in Startups. You were
getting twice a week, yeah.
Yeah, you were kind of getting more involved in podcasting, like you were setting up a podcast network. What happened to that?
Yeah, so we started one called This Week In, and I did it with my friend Kevin Pollack, and we got up to about a dozen shows or more. We tested a bunch of stuff, and we figured out exactly how to make a podcast work. And you need to have somebody who is very notable in their vertical, who is willing to spend 5-10 hours a week on their podcast and not make any money for 2 or 3 years. and then they slowly build an audience. And so if you look at, you know, what's worked in podcasting, you know, you have Leo Laporte, who's been at it for a long time, or me, or Mark Morin, whatever his name is, the WTF podcast. You know, it's somebody doing it almost as a loss leader for the rest of their life. And then maybe after a couple of years, talk about investing in yourself, maybe after a couple of years, it clicks, you know?
Yeah, I mean,
and then it becomes a business. So then if you try to build a network of them, nobody's been able to do that because these people are too big of personalities who are doing this for fun, and they don't want to have a boss or be part of something bigger.
Right.
So if somebody could go and get Leo, myself, Kevin Pollack, you know, and the other big podcasters out there to form a mega network, sell the advertising, it would be pretty amazing. But, you know, I don't think Adam Carolla, you know, or Adam Curry, Leo Laporte, myself, or any of those egos could all fit into one company. And so once we realized that after, you know, 12 to 24 months of trying, I basically gave all the investors, including myself, back like 60 or 70 cents on the dollar. Because I was like, listen, it's not going to work. It'll work for one. It will work for my podcast. It'll work for Kevin's podcast. But, you know, Kevin Pollack's done this amazing podcast. It doesn't really print money, but it is fascinating for him. It builds his relationships. It gets him auditions and work. So, and it serves his intellectual curiosity. And I think it's his legacy. You know, the guy's done 150 amazing interviews. So, you know, there's cool stuff that comes out of this, but a business, you know, will happen for an individual, and it'll become a couple of $1 million a year business at best.
Yeah, interesting. No, I've been looking at the space quite a bit, obviously, because I've been doing this podcast now for about 8 or 9 months, and it's definitely been an interesting learning experience.
Yeah. Do you think it's going to be a business?
You know, I think the hosting of podcasts is a decent business. I think it's like anything. I think the picks and shovels are already starting to make money. The biggest podcasts out there, like certainly Adam Carolla and Mark Maron, are making a decent living from it.
$2 million, yeah.
Yeah, Freakonomics, you know, American Public Media, all of these companies are making, you know, decent money from it. You know, as a network, I don't know. You'd have to think of some extra secret sauce to kind of bind the network together. And I don't know what that is.
Yeah, good luck with that.
Well, Jason, thanks so much for coming on to the podcast. Again, knowing you for almost 20 years, you've done really well. It's been really impressive to see every incarnation. Let me ask you one more question. After Silicon Alley Reporter went down, before Weblogs Inc. Went up, how did you you were kind of dealing with this maybe – I don't know what you were going through, actually. I didn't talk to you at all at that point. I was going through my own thing. And were you feeling depressed? Were you feeling that something's going to happen that's going to pick up? Or What did you go through to keep intact and then kind of come back?
Yeah, I was bummed that the party was over. In a way, it was almost like the end of the 60s or something. It was like, oh my God, what happened to this whole like crazy Woodstock thing? The party's over. And then, you know, I sort of, it was like hard to lay people off. So it wasn't fun. But I knew that I wasn't a fraud and I knew I could rebuild it. And I wasn't depressed as much as I was hungry to bring back that magic and to have fun again. And so I just went all out to try to find, you know, another party, another huge wave to ride. You know, I was like, I'm a surfer. Okay, it's low tide. Let's find another beach. And blogging was that beach. It was like, wow, there's big waves here. Or these waves could get big. It was probably more likely. And so I just got out there and kept surfing, you know. And I think to a certain extent I've been lucky because nobody really had big expectations for me in my life. I think, you know, I was a kid from Brooklyn who they thought would become a cop. And so all my life, people had very low expectations. So as a consequence, I think I had low expectations for a little while of my own existence until I, you know, had a friend named John Brockman who just told me to dare to be great when I was doing well in my life. And he said, dare to be great, like go bigger, you know. And then I got sort of addicted to going bigger and trying to do bigger and bigger and bigger things, trying to make them more impactful. And so that's where I am now. And that's where I was then, which was, hey, this party ended, but I want to keep the party going. I want to do something more fun. I want a bigger challenge. And blogs was it, you know, and then became Mahalo trying to take on Google search and didn't work, but Inside's doing really well and taking on news, you know, and like, oh wow, phones were created while I was creating Mahalo. Smartphones came out. Like, okay, good. There's a good pivot. I love doing my show. I love doing my events. I love angel investing. So I keep creating more adventures and challenges for myself. And I'm lucky. I didn't, you know, I have friends who went to Harvard or Columbia and, you know, their parents were very successful. And so they but, have, you know, this also, like,
just
expectation
like,
to do better. You I know, don't have I, this expectation.
I think also you're a super connector. So you basically always sort of land in a situation and immediately like, connect to everybody that's important. I think that's luck favors the prepared, and I think that's a valuable skill that you have.
Okay. I guess so. I mean, I always have been prepared, that's for sure. I always read up on everything. I always try to have more knowledge than I need. So like I get obsessive about that, you know? So if I'm going somewhere, I just start reading. And so it's pretty interesting. Like somebody was like, wow, you're so smart, Jason. You just know about everything. And I was like, I don't think I'm that smart. They're like, no, Jason, you're like one of the smartest people I've ever met. I'm like, no, that I know that's not true. So what exactly are you experiencing? I'm like, oh, I'm well-read. I can speak on a range of subjects because I constantly read and I constantly talk to other people. So if you talk to other people and you ask questions all the time, some of it's going to rub off. You'll seem smart.
What books are you reading right now, or what would you recommend?
Oh, God. Let's see. I really like this book, Creativity, Inc., which is...
yeah, I like that book.
It's a really good book by the guy who founded Pixar. His name is Ed Catmull. Really, really smart cat. I read a book called Bird by Bird recently by Anne Lamont.
Very good book about writing.
It's about writing, and it's really great.
I would say that and On Writing by Stephen King are my two favorite on writing books.
Yeah, On Writing by Stephen King is great. I've read that. And I started reading this Capital in the 21st Century, you know, the French dude.
Yeah, Thomas Piketty.
Yeah, I didn't like it.
No.
It's bad. The Martian is very good. Halfway through that. It's about a guy who, like, isn't a Martian mission and how he would survive on Mars if everything hit the fan and went bad. It's just a weird, awesome book that somebody told me about. Let's see. What else do... Oh, you know what? Born Standing Up is great by Steve Martin. If you haven't read that.
Oh, yeah. That's actually my favorite autobiography by a comic.
It's the only autobiography by a comic I've read, and it's pretty fantastic. So that's good that I started at the top. And went backwards. There's a really good memoir called All Over But the Shoutin' by Rick Bragg. Very good audiobook. All Over But the Shoutin'. Amazing audiobook. What else is really good?
Have you read 0 to 1 by Peter Thiel?
I have not. I will at some point. Any good?
Excellent. It's actually probably one of the best business books I've read this year.
Really?
Or ever, actually.
Oh, like, wow. That's
like,
high
I think it's really excellent.
Better than Good to Great.
Much better than Good to Great. Much better.
Right, let's see.
I liked Good to Great as well.
Let's see. 0 to 1, read by Blake Masters. I like to do audiobooks. It's my thing.
Now you said one final thing. Are you a surfer?
No.
Because what you said was interesting about, you know, you wanted to catch the next wave. And often in surfing, it's not the first wave that all the professional surfers go for. It's the second or third wave where
professional
surfers know that that's the wave that's going to win them the championship. And it certainly has been true on the internet that the first wave kind of came and went. Then there was a second wave, which was sort of like this 2003 to 2007 time. And now we're in this third wave with, you know, $150 billion valuations coming out of IPOs. This really seems like the wave the professionals are going for.
Yeah. I mean, right now, like everything that's happened in the internet right now is like the epilogue. It's like, oh, by the way, all that shit that went down, this is what happened before it. Just so you know. So like everything we experienced is like the epilogue. And I think like what's happening right now is the story, because what we did was we helped get everybody online at the end of the day. We helped people get interested in it. Well, they're all online now. And there's a whole generation that's grown up only knowing this. That's the actual generation.
Right.
We were the transition generation. We're like the people who didn't have TVs, who figured out which way to point the camera and how to set up a TV at home and put the antenna up. And then there was a whole generation that came in the 70s and 80s and it was like, yeah, well, of course you have TV. Like, we grew up only knowing television. And then all of a sudden, now we're in the golden age of television. They call the old age of television the golden age. The golden age is now, when the top actors in the world would rather do television than do movies.
Right. Well, it's interesting because back then it was difficult to actually even convince a company like American Express that they needed a website. Or HBO, I had to convince them to actually buy the domain name HBO.com, which they didn't own.
Yeah, they were like, why would we waste $50 a year on that?
Well, the cost was $250,000.
Because they had to buy it from some squatter.
Well, there was a medical company called HBO.
Got it. Genius.
So, but to HBO's credit, they bought it in 1994.
Ha.
But anyway, Jason, thanks so much. I really appreciate you spending the time. I know you're a busy guy. Congrats on everything. And thanks again for coming on the podcast.
It was my pleasure. You're supposed to ask me to do a promo at the end.
What do you want a promo?
not a promo. Like I got to cut a promo for you. Hey, everybody. It's Jason Calacanis, and you're listening to the James Altucher Show.
Excellent. Thanks very much.
There you go. Bye. I'll talk to you.
Talk to you soon.
Bye.
For more from James, check out the James Altucher Show on the Stansberry Radio Network at stansberryradio.com and get yourself on the free insiders list today.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.